You are now listening to Mark's Unexplained World by Mark the Medium from Hinckley Community Radio, a non-profit podcast radio station. Tonight's episode is about the Cock Lane Ghost. So it's over to you, Mark.
The location of the Cock Lane Ghost was a lodging house in, of all places, Cock Lane, which was a short road adjacent to London's Smithfield Market and just a few minutes' walk from St Paul's Cathedral. These paranormal events all started in the January of 1762 and were centred around three main people. A usurer, which was an early name for a loan shark named Mr. William Kent from Norfolk, a parish clerk called Richard Parsons, and his 11-year-old daughter, who was named Elizabeth Parsons. This reported phenomena of unexplained noises, which include both knockings and rappings, were typical of those as described in many other poltergeist cases. The Cock Lane Ghost became the focus of controversy between the Methodist and Anglican churches. It was also referenced frequently in contemporary literature. For example, Charles Dickens is one of several Victorian authors whose work alluded to the Cock Lane Ghost story, and the pictorial cartoonist William Hogarth referenced the ghost in two of his prints. Greetings, Unexplainers. Thank you for tuning in again and listening to this haunted episode of Mark's Unexplained World. My name is Mark Hughes. I'm a psychic medium, a ufologist, and a man who would like to be famous, but in an anonymous way. In this episode, I'm going to tell you about the wall-banging story surrounding the Cock Lane Ghost. And this week's necessary disclaimer: this story is not so much a ghost story, but more of a report, so I can't see anyone getting any nightmares by listening to it. However, it does contain details of a mother dying during childbirth and an infant death. So, you do listen at your own discretion, with all the opinions and comments being strictly my own, but with the facts still remaining. I also apologise if I pronounce anything incorrectly. What can I say, but words are what words are worth. Anyway, let's get back to the story. First, let's have a look at the story behind the people who frequented the lodgings of Cock Lane. The year is 1756, or according to some reports, 1757. And Mr. William Kent, an usurer, or loan shark, from Norfolk, marries a young lady named Elizabeth Lins, who was the daughter of a grocer from Lynham in North Wiltshire. Once married, both William and Elizabeth Kent moved to Stoke Ferry in Norfolk, where husband William Kent kept an inn and then later on a local post office. The couple, by all accounts, were very much in love. The language of love. However, their marriage was very short-lived as, unfortunately, within a month of moving to Stoke Ferry in Norfolk, Elizabeth Kent died during childbirth. Elizabeth's sister, Frances Lins, otherwise known as Fanny, during Elizabeth Kent's pregnancy, had moved in with the couple and stayed at the home in Stoke Ferry, mainly to care for the baby and its father. Unfortunately, the infant boy did not survive very long either, but rather than leave, Frances Lins, or Fanny, decided to stay on so she could take care of the grief-struck William Kent and help look after his home. soon both William Kent and Francis Lynns began a relationship of their own. However, they were unable to get married due to canon law. A little interesting side note here, canon law, put simply, is how the church organises and governs itself. The word canon basically means law. And as there are about 1.3 billion Catholics in the world, the church administrates a large collection of institutions. Therefore, the church needs an organisational structure to carry out its office of governance and its saving mission. Remember, every society needs laws, and this includes the church. There's an old saying, Ubi societis ibi lex, which, when translated, means, where there is a society, there is law. Due to this canon's law, William Kent travelled down to London to seek advice, where he was told that because his late wife Elizabeth had given him a living son, a marriage or union with her sister Fanny was impossible. So in January 1759, William Kent gave up the post office, left Fanny, and moved down to London with the intention of purchasing a place in some public office, in the hopes that business would erase that passion he had, unfortunately indulged in, with Elizabeth's sister. Meanwhile, Fanny moved out of the Stoke Ferry home and stayed with one of her brothers in Lynham in Wiltshire. Fanny started to write passionate letters to William Kent, which, according to reports, were filled with repeated entreaties to spend the rest of their lives together. This relationship was totally disapproved of by her family, you know.
Was it?
Oh, yes. Anyway, after many, many pulse-racing letters from Fanny, William Kent eventually gave in and allowed her to join him at some lodgings in East Greenwich, near London. The two then decided to live together as man and wife, or, as they called it back then, living in sin, making wills in each other's favour and hoping to remain discreet. However, these living arrangements didn't last very long, as their landlord soon found out about the couple's relationship from Fanny's family. But not only that, as it turns out, the landlord did actually owe William Kent, who, if you remember, was an usurer or loan shark, the sum of £20. For various reasons, possibly because he felt the couple were living in sin, the landlord refused to pay the remainder of the loan to William Kent, so Kent had the landlord arrested. This, of course, meant that both William and Fanny were going to be made homeless. A few days later, while the couple attended early morning prayers at the local church, William Kent and Fanny met a gentleman called Richard Parsons, who was the officiating clerk. Richard Parsons was generally considered a respectable man. However, he was also known as the local drunk, who was struggling to provide for his family. Richard Parsons listened to William Kent and Fanny's problems regarding somewhere to live, and was very sympathetic, so much so that he offered them the use of lodgings in his own home on Cock Lane. The three-storey house on Cock Lane was in a respectable but rapidly declining condition and comprised of a single room on each floor, which was connected by a winding staircase. The couple, still keeping up the pretense of being married, still called themselves Mr. and Mrs. Kent, and after they moved in, William Kent loaned Richard Parsons 12 guineas to be repaid at a rate of 1 guinea per month. It was while William Kent was away at a wedding in the country that the first reports of paranormal phenomena at Cock Lane began. After this first short break, in part two, we will look at some of the early hauntings at Cock Lane and more of the hidden history of William and William Kent and Fanny.
This show is brought to you courtesy of Neil Packer and the Haunted Antiques Paranormal Research Centre. Find them online at www.hauntedresearchcentre.com or at 9211 Regent Street, Hinckley, LE10 1AW. Open on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. for guided tours of the haunted rooms at just £3 per person. Booking is essential at all times, and over 16s only, please, unless accompanied by an adult. The haunted rooms are extremely haunted, and paranormal activity could and has taken place at any time. Some areas and particular objects or items can be quite scary and unnerving. Membership is available for £25 to qualify for selective offers. And why not download the app, available on both iOS and Android, for only £3.99. To keep up to date with what is coming up at the centre.
Richard Parsons, the parish clerk, had a wife and two daughters. The eldest daughter, 11-year-old Elizabeth Parsons, was described as a little artful girl. William Kent asked the young Elizabeth to stay with Fanny, who was by then several months pregnant, and to share her bed while he was away at a wedding. It was at this point that both Elizabeth and Fanny reported hearing scratching and rapping noises coming from behind the bedroom walls. At first, Mrs. Patterson's attributed these noises to a neighbouring cobbler.
Parsons,
I do apologise. However, when the noises continued on a Sunday and Fanny asked if the cobbler worked on that day, Mrs. Parsons informed her that he did not work on a Sunday. There was also another witness to some of the paranormal activity at Cock Lane. The landlord, a Mr. James Franzen of the local pub, known as the Wheatsheaf, after visiting the Cock Lane residence, reported seeing a ghostly white figure ascending the winding stairs of the property. The landlord, who at this point was terrified, quickly returned home. Richard Parsons later went to visit the landlord at his home and claimed that he had also seen the very same figure on the winding staircase. William Kent and Fanny moved out of Cock Lane when Richard Parsons failed to repay the loan of 12 guineas. So with Fanny only weeks away from giving birth, William Kent decided they should move to a property at Bartlett Court in Clerkenwell. However, very sadly, soon after this, Fanny unfortunately died from smallpox, along with the child she was expecting. As time went by, William Kent became a stockbroker, and in 1761, he remarried. However, William Kent, not forgetting his previous career path, sued Richard Parsons for the unpaid loan, of which about 3 guineas was still outstanding. He finally managed to recover the remaining debt by the January of 1762, which, coincidentally, is when all the strange activity started up again at the Cock Lane residence. Shortly after William Kent and Fanny had left the Cock Lane lodgings, a young lady under the name of Catherine Friend had moved in. However, she wasn't there for very long either, and soon decided she would move out as she found the strange rapping and knocking noises, which had returned intermittently and now occurring more frequently, could not be stopped. It was discovered that these strange noises apparently emanated from Richard Parsons' 11-year-old daughter, Elizabeth, who also suffered herself from seizures and fits. But not only that, at the time, the house was also being regularly disturbed by other unexplained noises, likened again at the time to the sound of a cat scratching a chair. Richard Parsons was determined to find out where these strange noises were coming from, so much so that he hired a carpenter to remove the wainscoting from all around Elizabeth's bed. And he also approached the assistant preacher and rector of St. Bartholomew's the Great in West Smithfield, a man named John Moore, just to try to find out what was going on at his home in Cock Lane. Between the two men, they figured out that one of the ghosts probably belongs to Fanny's sister and William Kent's ex-wife, Elizabeth. But this had already been worked out anyway, while Fanny Lynn's lay dying on the bed from smallpox. So the two men concluded that the other spirit haunting William Parsons' home in Cock Lane must be that of Fanny Lynn's herself. I'll do a pause here while you sort it all out in your own heads and catch up.
Thanks for that, Mark. I think I need it this week.
Finished? Good. I shall continue. Back then, the idea that a person's spirit might return from the dead to warn or give messages to those who are still alive was a commonly held belief, one that today, in some people or cultures, is a belief that is still held. So the presence of two restless spirits with an important message to disclose was therefore an obvious sign to both the preacher John Moore and the landlord Richard Parsons. Together, John Moore and Richard Parsons devised a simple method to help them with their communication with the ghosts of Cock Lane. This was very simply one knock for yes and two knocks for no. The men started these spirit communication sessions by asking some simple questions just to build up some trust and general rapport with the spirits. However, things started to take a dark turn when they asked the spirit behind the knocking whether they had been murdered, and the reply was one knock for yes. It was conjectured that the mysterious figure in white, which was seen on the winding staircase that so terrified James Franzen, who, if you remember rightly, was the landlord of the local pub known as the Wheat Sheaf, was presumed to be the ghost of Elizabeth Kent, and that she had appeared there to warn her sister, Frances Lynns, or Fanny, of her impending death. Due to this spirit, who was thought to be Elizabeth Kent, suddenly disappearing, the homicide charge against William Kent, i.e. that he murdered Elizabeth Kent, was never acted on. However, repeated questioning of Fanny Lynn's spirit It was divined, or felt through supernatural insight, that she had not died from the effects of smallpox, but rather from arsenic poisoning. It was also concluded that because of the deadly toxin of arsenic that had been administered by William Kent about 2 hours before Fanny died, her spirit now wanted justice. John Moore, who, if you remember, was the assistant preacher, had also heard from Richard Parsons about how William Kent had continuously pursued him for the debt of 12 guineas that he was owed. And on top of that, John Moore had also heard from Elizabeth's sister, Anne Lynns, who had complained that at Fanny's funeral, the coffin lid was screwed down and that she and her family had not been able to see her sister's corpse before she was buried. That would have been quite a big deal back then, though not everyone's choice. This made John Moore come to the conclusion that Fanny's body might not have shown any visible signs of smallpox, and that as she had been poisoned, the lack of scarring would have been something that William Kent would have wanted to keep hidden away. Oh, what a tangled web we weave. Oh dear. I'll do that one again. Oh, what a tangled web we weave. As John Moore was a clergyman with inclinations toward Methodism, he was inclined to believe in and trust the spirit of Elizabeth Kent. However, just for the added support, he enlisted the aid of an early Methodist named John Broughton, who, upon visiting the house of Cock Lane on the 5th of January, left very convinced that the ghost was real. The story of the Cock Lane ghost spread throughout London like warm human organs on an operating table. And at the time, a magazine called the Public Ledger began to publish detailed accounts of the phenomena, and William Kent fell under the public's eyes of suspicion as a murderer. On a short interesting side note here, the Public Ledger is one of the world's longest running magazines. Today it still provides agricultural commodity news, analysis and prices. However, when it was established in 1760, it not only contained pieces of commodities in London, but a wide variety of political, commercial, and society news. After William Kent read the accusations that were made against him in the Public Ledger magazine, he was determined to clear his name, and so being accompanied by a witness, he decided to go and see the Methodist clergyman John Moore. Once there, John Moore showed William Kent the list of questions that he and Richard Parsons had drawn up for Elizabeth Kent's spirit to answer. However, there was one question that concerned William Kent greatly, and that was his and Fanny's marital status, prompting him to admit that they were never actually married. After hearing this, John Moore, with what I think was a sympathetic ear, then told William Kent that he did not think he was a murderer. Rather, he believed the spirit's presence indicated that, and I quote, "There was something behind, darker than all the rest. If you could go to Richard Parsons' house, you might be a witness to the same and be convinced of its reality." After this second short break, in part 3, we will look at more details regarding the spirit contact at Cock Lane and some of the legal implications that arose from it.
Fright Nights was established in 1999 as the first company in the world to offer overnight ghost hunt experiences to the general public, pioneering paranormal events since the last century. Fright Nights operates at hundreds of the UK's most haunted and exclusive venues. All events have their own team of experienced paranormal investigators, mediums and psychics. They have a VIP members club for regular returning guests, offering loyalty discounts and exclusive invitation-only events. They can also host private events for your family and friends. You can contact them on 07 852 998 628 or email them at office@frightnights.co.uk or take a look at their website at www.frightnights.co.uk where you can see the many locations they investigate and learn about them and the opportunities they have available. Hundreds of ghost hunters join Fright Nights every month for the most thrilling ghost hunting experiences they'll never forget. If you haven't been on a ghost hunt before, then why not join them to see what it's all about? Why not visit their social media sites for up-to-date information on all the places they visit and to see what's coming up in the future? They look forward to seeing you all soon. Fright Nights Ghost Hunting Events. Remember, only the original will do.
So, on the 12th of January, William Kent, along with the two doctors who looked after Fanny during her last few days, and the Methodist John Broughton, all went to visit Cock Lane to speak to the ghosts and spirits that are said to haunt there. On the house's upper floor, Elizabeth Parsons, who was the 11-year-old daughter of Richard Parsons, was put to bed with her younger sister, and then the bed was moved into the centre of the room so the audience could sit around the outside of the inside of the bedroom. The audience in this case consisted of William Kent, with the two doctors, Methodist Thomas Broughton, a relative of Richard Parsons and Miss Mary Fraser, and the clergyman, John Moore. And to be honest, if this wasn't intimidating enough for two small girls to trying to sleep in their bedroom, I don't know what is. All the audience were warned beforehand that the ghost or spirit was sensitive to disbelief and were asked that they act with respect. So, with everyone who was seated around the bedroom and settled comfortably, the séance began. First, Mary Fraser, who was Richard Parsons' relative, ran around the room calling out, and I quote,
"Fanny, Fanny, why don't you come? Do come. Pray, Fanny, come. Dear Fanny, come."
Needless to say, there was stunned silence. When nothing happened, clergyman John Moore said to everyone in the group that the spirit would not come as they were all making far too much noise. So he asked them all to leave the room, telling them that he would try to contact the spirits by stamping his foot. After about 10 minutes and much foot stamping, the audience were then told that the spirit had returned to the bedroom and that they could now all come back in. So, with pulses racing and nerves biting, the clergyman, John Moore, then started to run through his and Richard Parsons' list of questions, remembering one knock for yes and two knocks for no. And I quote, "Are you the wife of Mr. Kent?" "Did you die naturally?" "By poison?"
Did any person other than Mr. Kent administer it?
After a few more questions to the spirit from John Moore, a member of the audience suggested to William Kent, and I quote, "Kent, ask the ghost if you shall be hanged." He did so, and the question was answered by one single knock. I knew I'd get there. Sorry, one second. A furious William Kent then said, and I quote, "Thou art a lying spirit. Thou art not the ghost of my Fanny. She would never have said such a thing." A few days later, on the 18th of January, another seance was held, again in the bedroom at Cock Lane. In attendance this time were William Kent, John Moore, Stephen Aldrich, who was the local parish priest, a local chemist, although I really don't know why, and also making her second appearance was Richard Parsons' relative, Mary Fraser. On this occasion, when Mary Fraser called out to spirit, Stephen Aldrich used a candle to look under the bed, presumably to try to debunk the seance. However, it looked like the spirit did not want to reply, with Mary Fraser saying that the spirit probably doesn't like the candlelight.
Okay.
After a few minutes of this silence, the questioning continued. However, when John Moore asked Mary Fraser if she would ask the spirit if it would appear in court against William Kent, Mary Fraser refused to ask the question. When William Kent and Fanny lived at the house on Cock Lane, they had employed a maid called Esther Carrots Carlyle. She was nicknamed Carrots simply due to her red hair. Since she had moved from Cock Lane to a new job, and so consequently she knew nothing about any ghosts, spirits or hauntings. So, on a desperate hunt to seek any evidence of Fanny's poisoning, John Moore went to question her. Esther Carrots Carlyle told John Moore that Fanny had been unable to speak during the last few days before she died. So John Moore invited her to the next seance at Cock Lane, which was to be held on the 19th of January. Once she was there at Cock Lane, Carrots was then asked to confirm that Fanny had been poisoned. However, Carrots remained adamant that Fanny had said nothing to her, telling everyone in the bedroom that William and Fanny had been, and I quote,
"very loving and lived very happy together."
This time, the seance in the bedroom at Cock Lane centred on Carrots herself, who spoke to the spirits directly, remembering the reply as one knock for yes and two knocks for no. Carrots asked, and I quote,
"Are you my mistress?"
This knock was then followed by some scratching.
"Are you angry with me, madam?" "Then I am sure, madam, you may be ashamed of yourself, for I never hurt you in my life."
It was at this point that the seance suddenly ended. To try to get to the bottom of the whole Cock Lane ghost affair, the Mayor of the City of London, a Sir Samuel Fleeder, ordered a full investigation into the case. One of the first things that was done was the formation of a committee to look into it. The committee included amongst its ranks a Lord Dartmouth and a known exposer of frauds, John Douglas. This committee undertook a rigorous investigation of Elizabeth Parsons, who, if you remember, was the 11-year-old daughter of Richard Parsons, although probably 12 by now. Carrying out more seances in which more attempts were made to observe the phenomena and communicate with the spirit. According to Samuel Johnson, who wrote a detailed statement concerning the seance that was held on the 1st of February 1762 at the house of a local clergyman, he wrote, and I quote, "Elizabeth, having been put to bed with proper caution by several ladies, the committee failed to hear any noises emanating from nearby her and left the room. They were recalled sometime later when the ladies claimed they had heard knocks and scratches, but the committee still failed to hear anything themselves. On the assumption that the ghost was present, they informed it that they were going to the vault in a local church where they expected it to hold it to its promise, apparently made on an earlier session, that it would knock on Fanny's coffin. But sadly, they heard nothing there either." His statement concludes, and again I quote, "Upon their return, they examined and questioned the girl, but could draw no confession from her. Between the hours of 2 and 3 a.m., she desired and was permitted to go home with her father. It is therefore the opinion of the whole assembly that this child has some art of making or counterfeiting a particular noise, and that there is no agency of any higher cause. In other, simpler words, he thinks it's bullshit." On a quick interesting side note here, Samuel Johnson, who was often known as Dr. Johnson, was an English writer who made lasting contributions as a poet, playwright, essayist, moralist, literary critic, sermonist, biographer, and editor. In other words, very prolific. The Oxford Dictionary of National Biography calls him, and I quote,
"arguably the most distinguished man of letters in English history."
Disappointed that the spirit had failed to reveal itself, John Moore told William Kent that he believed the ghost was an impostor, and that he was somehow going to prove it. William Kent then asked John Moore to admit the truth and write an affidavit of what he knew or suspected, so as to end the whole Cock Lane ghost affair and restore William Kent's reputation. However, John Moore, who, if you remember, being a religious man, refused, telling William Kent that he still believed the spirit's presence was a reminder of his living in sin, referring to, of course, him and Fanny. John Moore's view of the couple's relationship was shared by many of the townsfolk, including Richard Parsons' wife, who believed that the supposed ghost of Elizabeth Kent had disapproved of her sister's new relationship. On the 3rd of February 1762, just a couple of short days after, another seance was held in the bedroom of Cock Lane. At this time, the spirit knocking continues unabated. However, by now a lot of scepticism was starting to spread amongst the townsfolk, and Richard Parsons had started to feel that he was in an extremely difficult position. Keen to prove that the spirit phenomena at Cock Lane was genuine, Richard Parsons allowed his daughter, 11-year-old Elizabeth, to be examined from the 7th to the 10th of February at a house in another part of London known as the Strand. And then, on the 14th of February, she was moved to yet another house in Covent Garden, again in London. 11-year-old Elizabeth Parsons herself was tested in a variety of ways, which included being swung in a hammock with her hands and feet extended. To be honest, What this particular experiment was meant to achieve, I really don't know, and I really couldn't hazard a guess. I suppose you can't either.
Well, I know I can't.
No. For the two nights at the Cock Lane house, the spirit was once again silent. Elizabeth Parsons was warned by the authorities that if no more noises were heard at Cock Lane by the 21st of February, both she and her father, Richard Parsons, would be committed to Newgate Prison. On a quick interesting side note, Newgate Prison was a prison at the corner of Newgate Street and Old Bailey Street, just inside the City of London in England. Built in the 12th century and demolished in 1904, the prison was extended and rebuilt many times to house the increasing number of criminals, so it remained in use for over 700 years, from 1188 to 1902. This threat by the authorities would have obviously made 11-year-old Elizabeth a very frightened young lady. So much so that before the last séance in the bedroom at Cock Lane, the maid saw young Elizabeth conceal on her person a small piece of wood that measured roughly about 6 by 4 inches and informed the investigators. During this last séance, more scratches were heard, but the observers concluded that Elizabeth Parsons was herself responsible for all the noises. And not only that, but they also realised that she had been forced by her father to make them. A pamphlet that may or may not have been written by Anglo-Irish novelist Oliver Goldsmith was published on the 25th of February 1762 under the title of The Mystery Revealed. It contained a series of transactions and authentic testimonials respecting the supposed Cock Lane ghost, which had, until then, been concealed from the public. This pamphlet declares William Kent to be innocent. William Kent, meanwhile, took Richard Parsons and his family to court, accusing them of attempting to murder him and of having poisoned his partner, Fanny. Richard Parsons was sentenced to stand 3 times in the pillory and sent to prison for 2 years, and his wife for 1 year, with their servant being imprisoned for 6 months for collusion. A very quick interesting side note, the pillory is a device that is made of either a wooden or metal framework erected on a post. It has holes for securing the head and hands and was used during the medieval and Renaissance periods for punishment. The punishment being, of course, public humiliation and physical abuse. The pillory is very much related to the stocks. Well, people, what more can I say about this case? When I first looked at it as a potential episode for Mark's Unexplained World podcast, I saw that there was an awful lot of information on it. Maybe I was a little naive and thought to myself, hey, this will be a perfect little ghost story for my show. However, it wasn't until I started to write it down and put it together as a show that I realised how complex and involved it was going to be. That doesn't mean I regret doing it. Oh no, I love a challenge. And as I'm not just interested in the paranormal, I'm interested in all things with a bit of strangeness added to it. I've relished every moment. I mean, let's face it, this episode had everything that a good paranormal stroke crime thriller needed. Dead bodies, suspected homicide, poisoning, innocent children being used as pawns, the relentless investigator, and to cap it all off quite nicely, a couple of spirits thrown in for good measure. What more could you ask for? I think this case is a case of its time. A time when the church had a much stronger influence on the general public. Even with authoritative figures like judges and law enforcement. And as a result, people had a much stronger belief in things like the afterlife. And let's not forget how quickly the Cock Lane ghost story spread amongst the population of London, with everyone wanting to be part of this fascinating tale. Would it happen today? Well, probably not. But if it did, with the introduction of the internet, it would certainly make it travel a lot further, globally. I'll let the consequences of that thought sink in, shall I?
Thank you all for taking the time out to listen to this episode of Mark's Unexplained World. In our next episode, show number 93, we are going to be looking at tulpa. A tulpa is a concept originally from Tibetan Buddhism and found in later traditions of mysticism and the paranormal, of a materialized being or thought form, typically in human form. It is said that a tulpa is created through spiritual practice and intense concentration. Modern practitioners who call themselves tulbamancers use the term to refer to a type of willed imaginary friend, which many of them consider to be sentient and independent.
This show was written and researched by myself, Mark Hughes, and proofread and edited by Linda Hughes. The pronunciations of all the names and places, though, was all mine. The actors in this episode were Mark Hughes, Linda Hughes, and Denise Poulin, with special thanks to Neil Packer and the staff at the Haunted Antiques Paranormal Research Centre in Hinckley. And of course, a big thank you to everyone for listening. Mark's Unexplained World, because there's more to the paranormal than meets the third eye. And remember, guys, keep it real, because being real is better than being perfect. This show and all its contents are covered by basic copyright of Mark the Medium.